Okay, we're going to start our next presentation. It's Mr. Bob Trumpauer will tell us about Barney Dreyfus and the engineering of Forbes Field and how it was ahead of its time. Mr. Trumpauer.
All right. Thanks so much. There's kind of a symmetry to following the Dodgers and Giants presentation. I was born on the day Walter O'Malley announced he was going to leave Brooklyn for Los Angeles. So that was my birthday. And my mom used to go to games at Ebbets Field, and my dad was a rabid New York Giants fan. So, you know, as I said, it was neat to watch the two sessions on Los Angeles and San Francisco and the move from New York to the West Coast. So that was a lot of fun. I'll tell you what, that's a tough act to follow. And I want to thank everyone here who decided I'm going to eat dinner a little bit late. Thank you so much for sticking around. I really appreciate it. Going to talk a little bit about Barney Dreyfus and engineering Forbes Field. And I'll be honest, I am not an engineer, but I play one on TV once in a while. But what I'm going to do is sort of talk about some of the aspects that, you know, were ahead of, that made Forbes Field ahead of its time in 1909. So let me start from, you know, right from where stadiums took shape. First thing, as far as stadiums, the first stadiums were very austere, came out of Greece. Actually, I know a scholar named Romano talks about stadiums and asserts that it means the standing place, and it's pretty humble stuff. It really sort of took off when the Romans built these grand edifices, and you know it sort of had a consumption, and it was sort of a way for the Romans to sort of, you know, highlight the majesty of Rome and the Roman Empire. So you know, I think we kind of do that in the United States. You know, we build bigger, better, and you know, it keeps ratcheting up in some ways. As far as the four eras of stadiums, you have the early wooden ballpark era. And honestly, in that era, it was so haphazard and it was all over the place. And I know I've read scholars who talk about how during that era, there were times when, you know, if there was a, you know, homestand, there were times, if there were days in between the game, that they'd rebuild a new stadium somewhere else and the players would help, or they'd take the benches out and rebuild new ones with the players helping. I can't imagine that happening today, but that was the way it was back then. Then you had the concrete and steel era, and Forbes Field was really at the forefront of that. Then you have the post-World War II era, which, you know, I think most of us don't think of Milwaukee County Stadium as an amazing stadium, but it was highly influential in that it created a model where government subsidy was part of professional sports. And Walter O'Malley even talked about, the Milwaukee formula when he was trying to negotiate with Robert Moses. And as you all know, he really didn't get anywhere with Moses, and you know they didn't really get along. And today we have, you know, absolute luxury subsidies and the retro parks, you know, which started with Camden Yards. And as far as the first one in the United States, you have the Union Grounds. Brooklyn, New York, William Canmire. He actually was had a skating rink that he turned into. He wanted to make money in the off season, and tried to create an enclosed facility, and charged money for that, and that was a start. But then you had the Baker Bowl. This is the start of the concrete and steel era. Now the Baker Bowl was kind of a mess. You know, the Phillies played there. It was initially wood, then a fire burned the place down. And what happened is they rebuilt it with concrete, brick, and steel. But underneath that concrete, you know, brick and steel, was wooden structures. So it still had, you know, some wood built into it. Capacity was probably about the size of a AAA stadium right now. And then you had Cincinnati's Palace of the Fans. It was built in 1902 with concrete, brick, and steel sections. But, the wings, you know, had wood, so it really wasn't like Forbes Field, entirely concrete and steel. Capacity was listed as 6,000, but on opening day, 10,000 attended. I was in the archives at the Cincinnati Library, and I found the newspaper coverage of the opening, and it may actually be the first time that the opening and christening of a baseball ballpark was a front page story. At least it's the earliest I could find. And then this is shifting to football, but Harvard Stadium was the first fully concrete and steel stadium, and it still stands today. What's kind of interesting is, and I'm a faculty member, so I teach at a university, but a faculty member supervised the construction, a guy named I.M. Hollis, and at Harvard they joked, they called it the Holliseum and, you know, had fun with it. But if you can imagine putting me in charge of putting a stadium together, I don't think it would stand very long. But it just shows you how the game has changed. And they did some pretty amazing things with Harvard Stadium, and it still stands today. Then you had the real concrete and steel era ushered in, Shibe Park in Philadelphia. It was really the first fully fireproof ballpark for a professional team sport in the United States. It housed the Athletics initially, not the Phillies. First game was on April 12, 1909, so it pretty much opened the season for the Athletics. And then you had Forbes Field, which opened on June 30th, 1909, and they played their rival, the Cubs. And they did lose on that opening day, and Pirates fans, I think, are getting used to losing to the Cubs, unfortunately. Fans received a commemorative stick pin at the game, and that was sort of a precursor to some of today's modern giveaways. As far as opening day, Barney Dreyfus, got a lot of credit for it. One of the things he said about it on opening day is it was indeed the happiest day of my life. Can you imagine going through your life and, you know, saying this is the happiest day of my life? But the Pittsburgh Press wrote, the ceremonies were attended by the largest throng to attend an event of this kind in this or any other city in the country. Forbes Field is so immense, so far behind anything else in America in the way of a baseball park, that old experts used to judging baseball crowds at a glance were at a loss for reasonable figures. And the Pittsburgh Press sort of showed how difficult that was for them. They estimated 35,000 at the game. The actual gate attendance for the game, and they did have turnstiles and they had ways to count, it was 30,338. So that was the actual attendance they had overestimated, because it was just jam-packed. And really the capacity of Forbes Field was about 25,000, so they really shoehorned a lot of people in. And again, the Pirates lost to the Cubs. What made Forbes Field historic? A number of things. It was better engineered and more impressive than the other facilities of the time. And I know I've tried to sort of identify sports facilities that have been sort of transformative. And, you know, we think of Forbes Field as this quaint, small place, but it was more magnificent than the other facilities of that era. So it was really an impressive place. It was also built to be permanent. Up until then, at that point in time, they would, the side bleachers and things, they'd just take them down and put new things up. And, there were really temporary aspects to ballparks. I think another thing that was a major thing, and this was one of the things that made Forbes Field transformative, it was built to attract an upscale audience. I mean, I think that's an important aspect of what made Forbes Field historic and unique. How big was the project? Shibe Park took 490 tons of steel to build. Forbes Field required almost three times that amount. So that gives you a sense of how big it was. The Polo Grounds in Shibe Park were probably considered the two best facilities of that time. But Forbes Field really became sort of the new yardstick. So it was an impressive place. Here's something I found. I thought this was interesting from the Pittsburgh Post. And it was in February of 2009. And it just gives you an indication of how many rail cars of materials had to be brought in to build Forbes Field. And it was considered pretty amazing how much they brought in. And sort of the influences, of the era, sort of the shift from, just hand merchandising goods to assembly line was sort of part of the construction of Forbes Field. You know, that sort of Frederick Taylor efficiency management and that sort of thing. As far as the construction inventory, here's a list of what was brought in. 45 freight cars of cement and terracotta, 300 cars of gravel and sand, 21 cars of sewer pipe, glass, frames, sash, elevators and fertilizer. We'll talk a little bit more about maybe why fertilizer is important in a few minutes. But 60 cars of brick and lumber, 60 cars of steel, 30 of chairs. And, you know, they had chairs that they brought in from factories in the Midwest. That was sort of a difference. They weren't built on site. They were trucked in via train and built in. Then 21 cars of cornice, ornament, iron, roofing, sod, plumbing, and railings. So that's the inventory. Pittsburgh was probably an apt place for building sort of a transformative ballpark. It was a national leader in a lot of ways in sort of industrialization of America. By 1901, about two-thirds of the steel that was produced in the entire United States came out of Pittsburgh or the Pittsburgh area. About 30% of the entire world's steel production came out of the Pittsburgh area as well. So that gives you a sense of how Pittsburgh was actually pretty big player in industrialization. And Forbes Field was a pretty good example of Pittsburgh's industrial prowess. It was the first million-dollar ballpark. And as far as the engineering and planning, Dreyfus did a lot more advanced planning than previous team owners and tried to sort of figure out how to build something that was special and unique. He hired a guy named Charles Welford Levitt, not related to the guy who created Levittown in the suburbs. This is a different one. He actually worked, he's from the New York metropolitan area. He's actually from New Jersey, close to New York. But he worked with a number of wealthy folks creating a lot of gardening and a lot of rich estates and that sort of thing. But he also was involved. His intro to sports and sports-related construction was horse racing. He did the designs of some of the facilities at Belmont Park and Saratoga in upstate New York. So that was sort of his start. And he was identified by Dreyfus as someone who could really do a good job of designing it. Now, if you know Exposition Park, the place where the Pirates played before Forbes Field, it was a mess as far as flooding and water and all that sort of thing. It was on the north side. And I have to say, Dreyfus, knowing that water problems were endemic to the old ballpark, brought in a guy who actually was an engineer with expertise in the Panama Canal. So that was one thing he did to sort of further address engineering issues. Okay, some other things that made Forbes Field unique. The amenities were cutting edge for its time. Telephones were available for persons on site. And if you think about it, that was pretty far ahead of the curve. There was no other ballpark that did that at the time. Although I did find that Albert Spaulding, when he had a ballpark in Chicago, actually had a phone in his private box. So this wasn't the first place to have phones, but it was the first place to have phones that could be used by the public, I think. If someone can find something different, I'd like to find that out so that I know I'm accurate, but I haven't been able to find anything. As a point of reference, the rotary dial phone wasn't even invented until 1919, about 10 years later. The Ford Model T, there was underground parking. And in fact, it was touted as one of the greatest underground parking garages, in the region. And, you know, the Ford Model T basically, you know, started rolling off the Ford plant in 1908. So that shows you how far ahead. We're building in 1909, a year after the Ford Model T's introduced. They're actually thinking about, let's build a parking garage in here. That's kind of advanced, you know, and I think O'Malley and Stoneham would have probably liked that when I saw those New York pictures with lack of parking. They also had on-site washing machines, and not only on-site washing machines, but they had on-site washing machines for the visitors, so you could dry your clothes, wash your clothes, and all that sort of thing, and get in and get out. So that was somewhat unique as well. As far as the other thing, making Forbes Field an elite experience, the Pittsburgh Post touted the location as one of the most exclusive districts in the city, and as a matter of fact, you know, it was near Schenley Park, and Dreyfus actually worked closely with Andrew Carnegie, one of the acknowledged heavy hitters in industrialization in America, you know, who was, you know, worked in the Pittsburgh area and did a lot of things. It contained box seats that gave people their own personal space. So that was something that was unique. It also had ramps that allowed patrons easier access to their seats, something we kind of take for granted with today's ballparks rather than stairs and that sort of thing. The other thing is that it had a third tier with its own entrance, and it was sort of a luxurious precursor to skyboxes. But one of the things about this particular third tier, he actually built in an elevator to get back and forth. So I think it was also the first to actually have an elevator built in for, you know, for the sort of folks who wanted that little extra luxury. And, you know, as far as, you know, just some of the accounts from outside of Pittsburgh, Ring Lardner of the Chicago Tribune wrote, "Women came dressed as if for the greatest society event of the year." Now, knowing Ring Lardner, and a lot of times he would kind of do some digging, but, you know, he actually kind of did. He said, and it probably was, you know, sort of digging at Pittsburgh. As far as luxury, just talking, you know, getting quotes from some of the players gave a sense of how the luxury sort of changed the aspect of the players and how they perceived and played the game. You know, Christy Mathewson said when fielding, he said that you have to be careful because a player could easily lose a fly ball in the glint of diamonds in the stands. You know, because the women would come to the game, you know, dressed up and looking, you know, and looking the part as though it was an upscale social event. And, you know, another thing that, you know, sort of related to that is, you know, they had pretty much almost an equivalent amount of restrooms for men and women, which was a bit ahead of its time as well. But Honus Wagner explained that the more upscale audience changed the players' behavior, and he asserted that that in essence, the players had to be a little bit more civilized, and they had to, and his quote was, they had to stop cussing during games, you know, just because the fans could hear you. And as far as the other thing about Forbes Field that made it somewhat unique is it was somewhat of an all-purpose venue. You know, I think a lot of sports facilities have been used as all-purpose venues, you know, even prior to Forbes Field. But I think Forbes Field did some interesting things that, you know, might have been, you know, sort of revolutionary. One thing they had was something called the Hippodrome that I found full-page articles about. And this is an example of one of the full-page articles. They also had fireworks, which, you know, are so commonplace in baseball now, but they didn't make it part of baseball. What they did is they played the baseball game in the afternoon, and then Barney Dreyfus made money charging people to come in for the fireworks, and they'd have a band there, and they'd all, you know, sort of watch the fireworks. So it was sort of a moneymaker for him. And in fact, one of the things that really prompted, that was a major motivator for Dreyfus is, he decided to hire double shifts to make sure it was finished before July, before the July 4th weekend. He targeted June 30th is when he wanted to open it up, and he had double shifts because he really wanted that revenue from the fireworks shows and that sort of thing. So it was pretty much an all-purpose venue in a lot of ways. And, you know, as far as Pittsburgh, it was on the national stage in that first season of Forbes Field, the World Series versus the Detroit Tigers. Fans visited Forbes Field from throughout the nation as a result of that, and it did get a decent amount of positive press. Now, for a team that, you know, just moved in, you know, in 1908, they actually, the Pirates were edged out by the Cubs, and we all know where that went. There were, you know, over a century of difficulty with the Cubs. But at the same time, you know, the Pirates won in 1909, and, you know, it was somewhat storybook, but at the same time, the series ended in Detroit, so it wasn't quite exactly storybook. That's kind of how it went. But as far as Forbes Field, it also hosted a number of other events, and here's some of the other events that you might notice. You know, the 1909 World Series, the 1925 World Series, the All-Star Games in 1944 and 1959, as well as the World Series in 1960. Now, one thing sort of is a closing point. Nationally, President John Hadler, kept an opening day photo of Forbes Field on the wall directly opposite his desk. And, he did that because he recognized the transformative dimension of Forbes Field. Now, one of the things that was underneath the photo, very neatly printed, was Forbes Field, opening day, attendance, 30,338. So, you know, it was Heidler's recognition that Forbes Field really made a difference in the future of baseball and the future of spectatorship. So as far as just, you know, looking at some of the things, you know, Yankee Stadium sort of put Forbes Field to shame. You know, it was a pretty amazing facility. It was actually the first place I went to a professional ball game in. My dad took me to see Whitey Ford versus Blue Moon Odom, I remember in the 60s. But, that was sort of, you know, the next big stadium. And the Yankees, people think of the Yankees as this huge franchise, big power and all that stuff. They were actually the last team to play home games in a wooden ballpark. So Yankee Stadium was their shift away from a wooden ballpark. And then you have the Astrodome, which I've researched pretty extensively, which in essence, you know, took the luxury of Forbes Field and ratcheted it up to ridiculous dimensions with, you know, theater-style seating, private clubs, all kinds of other things. And then you had the era of the cookie-cutter stadiums, which the Astrodome was a part of. But, Three Rivers you have on the top right, and I see St. Louis and Oakland with that monstrosity of Mount Davis. Even the Sky Dome is sort of a cookie cutter if you look at it closely. Orioles Park at Camden Yards sort of brought back that sort of Forbes Field charm to some degree. And if you look at it, I just know when I visited, it's kind of interesting. It's a neat place. But the idea for Camden Yards actually came from an architecture student from Syracuse University, believe it or not. It wasn't something that, you know, the lords of baseball cooked up. This guy, you know, was sort of, you know, selling the thing, and eventually HOK, which is now Populous, said, wow, that's a pretty good idea. Let's steal it. Today's palace is actually, AT&T Stadium in Texas, where the Cowboys play, not baseball, but it actually has significantly more televisions than Yankee Stadium and more monitors. And, you know, I know when I toured that, it was, the technology was pretty absurd and over the top. And that's where we are right now. Mike Lupica, I know in 2014, called it Jerry Jones Palace of Versailles. So you can sort of see how luxury has just increasingly ratcheted itself up over and over again. But Forbes Field was an important part of ballpark evolution. And, you know, it came at a time when new entertainment options were being introduced to all Americans. I think of Kennywood, you know, which is a theme park which opened up not too far from here in West Mifflin, Pennsylvania, which is, you know, right near Pittsburgh. And, you know, I also think of the emergence of the film industry. So people were going to Nickelodeons. So Barney Dreyfus actually, you know, by building a ballpark that people wanted to go to, that actually had trolley service nearby in an upscale neighborhood that people thought, you know, was worth visiting, you know, sort of, I think, helped baseball to become the kind of entertainment option that fans wanted to see versus jumping to other entertainment options. It also connected sport with civic pride. You could see, as an example, in the newspaper clippings and all of the things that I read, you know, how there was a real sense of pride with Forbes Field, and, you know, that the folks in Pittsburgh felt really good about the fact that they had a ballpark that was considered, you know, first rate, first class, and the best in the nation. So with that, I'd be glad to field any questions you might have. Thank you very much.
Two things. First of all, Comiskey was built in 1910.
Yeah. Yeah, Forbes. Yeah, what's kind of weird is this. The question was about Comiskey, and it was built in 1910. And, you know, were there any parallels? I'm sure there were some parallels. I will say Charles Comiskey was kind of cheap. He built it over a garbage dump, and there were some issues with it. But, you know, it was very much ahead of its time, and there was sort of a gradual flow to parks that were more permanent. And, you know, one of the things that actually was driving the push to more permanent facilities, and I think one of the things that probably influenced it, was in 1912, a couple years after Comiskey was built, a fire in the Polo Grounds, which really did some serious damage to it. And at that point, you had sort of the government saying, we're not going to approve these wooden ballparks. You've got to start stepping it up and making these concrete and steel fireproof parks, or we're not going to allow you to continue to function. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I think that's what they wanted, but I also think, and Carnegie was, you know, when Carnegie was helping Dreyfus, it wasn't as though it was this altruistic thing. He owned a lot of that real estate, and in fact, Carnegie Tech, which is now Carnegie Mellon, you know, was built in that area as well. So, you know, for Carnegie, there were some self-serving purposes for him doing that. But at the same time, I think everyone benefited in the end as far as, you know, putting that together. But I think that, you know, the sort of notion of idyllic, you know, that Park Beautiful movement that, you know, was part of urban, you know, restoration and stuff, that actually Charles Leavitt was part of. He actually did a lot of things that had landscaping. And interestingly, that's probably why the bags of fertilizer were part of it. There was a lot of gardening around it as well, as you could see from one of those pictures. And I think that was probably Leavitt's influence. So, you know, I don't know if that helps, but that gives you a little bit of information that sort of, I think, gives some cultural context to the whole thing.
Yeah, how much of an influence was the University of Pittsburgh? Was it encroaching upon Forbes Field all along? Was that later?
No, that came later, I think. Uh-huh. Yeah, because it really wasn't. I don't think that. I think the university was far enough away at that point that it wasn't right on top of it as it is now with Postvar Hall, you know, right, being the place where home plate is actually enshrined in glass. You know, so, it took a while for Pitt to grow enough that it just came out and started taking over the land around where Forbes Field was.
And wasn't it about 1912 when the letter H was added to the name of Pittsburgh? Because there's some Pittsburgh without the H, and now it's with the H.
Going through the newspapers, it was so weird finding an H and a non-H. Okay. And I don't know when that, but it was like right around that sort of, early part of the century, right. 07 to about 10. Uh-huh. It was like a little bit of both. And okay. I couldn't make rhyme or reason of it. I wish I could, but I just couldn't.
We have a Pittsburgh in California with no H in there.
Okay, there you go. I'm sorry, I should have.
That's okay, thank you. Jumping forward to the 60s, I remember watching games on TV from the East Coast, and all of a sudden they had this new device for their tarp, where the tarp came out of the ground when they thought there was going to be a rain situation. That was the first time I'd ever seen anything like that, so I don't know what drove that in Pittsburgh when they did it, but I knew it was unique.
Yeah. I will say, Dreyfus was one of the first owners to actually adopt rolling the tarp out, and actually he had two large tarps to cover the full infield for Forbes Field in 1909. So, it's funny, but Dreyfus was not afraid to experiment and do things that he thought would be good for baseball. Okay.
Yeah, what do you think a stadium would cost in this day and age?
What's weird is, I know it was a $1 million ballpark. I think if you probably, I know there's, and I could probably find out in a couple seconds, but, if you did the consumer price index thing, which is not always the most reliable measure, but it's a measure that you could probably,
sit your hat on. Ballpark's costing $200-300 million.
I would say it probably was about somewhere in the range of $30 million. Uh-huh. If you go inflationary.
Yeah. Inflationary.
But I don't know.
Yeah.
Right now.
You figure that was a palace, like you said earlier. That's a palace back then.
Yeah.
Imagine
yeah.
today, it's like it would be even more of a palace.
Yeah. Yeah.
When you were talking about the capacity and the attendance, when I watched games there in the 60s, it appeared bigger. Was it expanded to a larger capacity?
Yeah, they did. In fact, it was initially about 25,000. They had built onto it, and it was a little bit past 35,000. So, probably not too pretty much in the same range as PNC now, I would guess. Yeah.
Also, was there ever any thought to try to keep it for any historical reasons, or was it demoed shortly after Three Rivers was built?
You know what? When they took Forbes Field down, honestly, the whole cultural ethos was we want modern, and there wasn't a thought of preservation. And it's funny, but if you really get into sort of urban history and those sorts of things, what's kind of bizarre is a lot of the sort of things that are preserved are almost, cultural accidents. So as an example, we think of Boston as a place where you have all these quaint ancient buildings and that sort of thing. Well, part of the reason that Boston had the quaint ancient buildings is a lot of the Washington, D.C. politicians didn't necessarily trust the Boston area politicos to be wise with the money, so that they didn't give them as much of the sort of urban renewal stuff to just knock down neighborhoods, and the result is Boston actually is probably better off for it. So there's sort of a weird dynamic whenever you think about urban history and how cities get shaped, and sometimes it's accidental.
Was the flagpole in play in center field part of the original plan, or did that come later?
I hate to sound stupid. I don't know. I'm just not sure. Does anyone know in here?
It made for some strange moments because they put the batting cage out in center field.
Okay.
Also after batting practice.
Yeah, and the sad thing is I didn't grow up in the Pittsburgh area, so I've been doing a lot of I never sat in Forbes Field. Again, my experience as a youngster was Yankee Stadium and Shea Stadium when it was relatively new. So I got the weird contrast of modern and old, mm-hmm. and that kind of influenced me sort of thinking about ballparks. All right. Do you? That's great stuff. You probably know more about Forbes Field than I do, because you've gone to probably dozens and dozens of games in Forbes Field. And you were telling me earlier, you started going there in 1934, which is absolutely remarkable. Okay.
I noticed your list of engineers and companies there early on. Did the Osborne Company have any influence in this?
You know, I got to be honest with you. I've got to do a little bit more research on that because I haven't been able to find specific Osborne Engineering involvement with it. But what's weird is ballparks.com mentions it, and there's something in the Notre Dame archives that mentions it. I actually probably should call the Osborne folks because they're actually still in business.
Yes, they are.
To find out what, you know, whether they were involved. And honestly, I would suspect that, and it wouldn't surprise me knowing how thorough Dreyfus was if he talked to the Osborne folks and had them involved in some way.
I would imagine. The Osborne Company does not have any of their records. They sold them off as collector's items.
Wow.
And they went to private collectors. As a matter of fact, if you have any of the originals of Yankee Stadium, you can make several thousand dollars at the moment.
Okay, yeah.
But you can get a number of the blueprints, and that, for instance, of Fenway and Braves.
Okay, yeah. And, you know, I know, as I said, part of the reason that I think Notre Dame had it in their archives is because Osborne did their football stadium.
Yes.
And, you know, I think they mentioned Forbes Field, which leads me to believe that somehow Osborne was involved in it, but I don't know the nature of it.
Yeah, because it was right after they did League Park in Cleveland.
Yeah, yeah, and League Park was built in 1910. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, yeah.
In effect, rebuilt. Yeah, you're right. But it's fascinating. Thanks, Bob.
Okay. Hey, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. As I said, thank you for delaying your dinner a little bit. I appreciate it.